a lot of training in the timing of movements and the getting the traffic control men out ahead of the column and getting them put in positions where they could direct the traffic in the right way so that people didn't get lost, then picking them up and getting them up ahead of the column again, all these sort of tricks that we had to learn in moving large numbers of vehicles and fitting in at a start point and dispersing properly at a dispersal point at the end of a move were all practiced over and over again. So we were frequently out for 2 and 3 days on exercises doing this, and if I remember correctly, we would move perhaps at night over to Kent, somewhere near the Kentish coast, deploy, simulate a brigade attack, receive our orders and beef our troops and go through this attack procedure, and then be picked up in our vehicles and move back to our billets or move to another area and do it all over again. So there was a lot of effort in this sort of large formation movement and the deployment of a large formation into an assault of some sort. But in between that and, well, there were, I guess, if I remember correctly now, my company commander, Hoffmeister, exercised us and trained us quite a bit in company tactics. It's rather hard to remember now in precise detail because I've been with the battalion for, about 6 or 8 weeks. When I think somewhere in the beginning of November we were sent down to Brighton to man the coastal positions right on the coast at Brighton. We had some positions at Brighton and some up on the downs up behind Brighton. And there we were fully committed to operational routine. We were manning the positions 24 hours a day right on the beach. As an officer, we had to take duty officer tours through the week, and you'd be up all night, and it would take you about an hour and a half to cover the inspection of your pickets. And about that time, you were required to start over, do it over again, so you'd go spend most of your night rushing up and down the your part of the seafront. Visiting your men and get much rest. So we did that, I think, until about Christmas time, 1940, and then I came back for another round of exercises, company training, very, very busy period. And then I left the Sea Force. I was a great fellow for getting into trouble, and I got into trouble again. I was punished, and by General Perks, who felt that I needed a challenge. He sent me to 1st Divisional Petrol Company to command a section, and I was transferred from the Sea Force to the Army Service Corps. I didn't like that very much at all. I went from commanding 40 men to a place where I was commanding about 40 trucks and about 80 men, and delivering half the petrol and oils and lubricants for the division. And all the other officers in this unit were 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 years older than me, and you know, when you're 20, anybody that's 25 looks like a grandfather almost. So I had nobody that I could really enjoy being making a pal of. I served with that unit. I had to was transferred and served with the 1st Division Ammunition Company and did a similar job delivering ammunition until the late winter of or the early winter of February 42, when an ad appeared in routine orders for officers, looking for officers who'd like to transfer into the Armored Corps. And that was my opportunity to get out of this old man's home, and I applied and was transferred to the Armored Corps, and then in June 44 I joined the Strathcona's. Made that my home until I got out of the forces in 71.
How did, you were transferred into the Armored Corps, how exactly were they organized at this point?
Just well, the 5th Division had just come over, 5th Armored Division. Had just been in England about 3 or 4 months then. They had lots of men, but not very many tanks. When I joined the Strathcona's, each squadron had 4 or 5 tanks. So they were busily training tank crews, exercising tank crews with those 4 or 5 old-fashioned tanks. They were old Lee tanks and Grant tanks, the old American predecessors of the Sherman.
These would be the ones with the 75mm gun out.
The 75 on the on the side, little side turret that had partial, you know, only partial traverse. And then it had the 75 on that, and then I think in the turret itself it had a 37mm, and there was a three old machine guns in down beside the co-driver or with the co-driver, and one up in the turret. And there may have been an ACAC one mount for the crew commander to use against aircraft. And there was very little in the way of intercom. I think you had to shout or blow whistles or kick the some crew commanders control the tank by kicking the driver in the shoulder. You know, if you kicked him in the left shoulder, he turned and pulled the left bar and so on. And I'm not quite sure how you got him to stop. But shortly after I joined the regiment, we started to get ram tanks, which was a tank patterned after the Sherman, I guess, devised by General Worthington. It had a molded, it had a cast steel hull, 6-pounder gun, which looked terrific in size compared to the 2-pounders we'd had on a lot of other tanks, some of the other tanks. And we trained on those.
The RAM never did go into action, really, though, did it?
No, it didn't, no.
No.
It did. It did, actually. It went into action as a sort of a, I think, a troop carrier. I think General Simmons took the turrets off
right,
them,
yeah.
And he made them into armored troop carriers to carry infantry into a big battle, which he had, was it the Battle for the Falaise Gap?
Yeah, they called it Kangaroos, I think, weren't they? Something like that?
Yeah, they called them Kangaroos, but I think they were the rams with the turrets taken off.
Was there something wrong with them, though, that they never used them as actual tanks, or...?
No, I really can't remember what the fear was, why they didn't go with them. I suppose about the time when we were going to Italy, we went to Italy, and we took over the Desert Rats, the 7th Armored Division's tanks. We traded with them. They were leaving Italy to go to prepare for the invasion of, and to participate in the Normandy invasion. So we picked up the Desert Rats tanks, and they were Shermans, which they brought over from the desert. And I guess the Americans had the supply line and all the logistics support for the Italian theater. And so it made sense to standardize on Shermans. That was the tank for British, American, everything in Italy. I think the first Armored Brigade may have had Churchills for a while. I'm not absolutely certain.
Some of the Canadian units had Churchills.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think, you know, they had Shermans too, because
yes,
they did.
When did you go down to Italy? When
we
down?
Went to Italy in the fall of 1943. October, I guess. We arrived in Naples around Armistice Day, I remember, and it was around the 10th or 11th of November. I was in the advance party, so I was perhaps a week or two ahead of the others. Our convoy was attacked in the Mediterranean. We had quite a bit of excitement there, and our sister ship was hit and sunk a day later.
Was this by aircraft or by?
There was aircraft with torpedo bombers.
Mm-hmm.
They attacked us just after we. Well, I think we passed Gibraltar about noon, and about 5 hours out of 5 or 6 hours past Gibraltar into the Mediterranean, just at dusk. These torpedo bombers attacked. I don't remember how many. And of course, as soon as the alarm went, we all had to go to positions, and my position was down about 3 or 4 decks down. So we never saw anything. I don't recall how long the thing lasted. I remember we used to, in those days, get fed twice a day on the ships. These were American Grace Line ships that I was on, and Santa Helena, I think, and the one that was hit was, I think, the Santa Maria. And I remember after 3 years in England, the food on these American ships was just terrific. You know, real cream in their coffee and beautiful coffee, and where we'd only have powdered eggs for 2 or 3 years in England, they had all the fresh eggs you wanted and real thick American ham. And, breakfast was just a tremendous treat. I remember after we'd been at sea for about a week or so, an American officer coming up on, now hear this, and sort of notice on the PA system to sort of plead with us that there were only, I think, 1,500 on the ship, but they'd been issuing food sufficient to feed 5,000. He was just wanting everybody to sort of cut back a bit because they were running pretty short of quite a few weeks.
I suppose it made up for the ships being dry, though, anyway. So
yeah.
A bit of a help.
Well, that was a big mistake on my part. I never really realized. We didn't know we were going to. The cover story when we went to the ship was we were going to Ireland. So it was only the odd, wise, smart guy who had a bottle or two in his pack. And those fellows were really very popular around 4 or 5 o'clock every evening. It was a very, very happy ship. We had to make a big diversion down along the coast of Africa, I gather, to, again, try to lead the Germans astray as to what our intentions were. And then they turned around and circled back and went up through the Med. So we were at sea for about 3 weeks out of UK. And I always remembered it as the devastating effect of women, because there was no women on our ship, and it was a very happy ship. We were getting tremendous food, and there were quite a few talented fellows who sort of sprang up, and it was just a treat to go into the officer's lounge after dinner in the evening, after it got dark, around 8 or 9 o'clock. There was always this impromptu concert that sort of developed. There was fellow really could play the piano, and it was a sort of a jazz combo had formed, and they played a lot of the old classics, and it sounds so simple and innocent, but it was so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then when this sister ship was sunk, or hit at first, it didn't sink until the day later, 14th Canadian General Hospital, which was a hospital recruited out of the Royal Victorian in Montreal, was on the other ship. So we picked up 30 or 40 Canadian nursing sisters. Mm. And immediately that happy group of men split up into 200 rivals, all trying to get the attention of some poor girl. So the rest of the journey into Naples was fairly unpleasant.
Happy to get there. I suppose everyone was quite keyed up about the idea of actually getting into action for the first time after 3 years of waiting, too.
Yeah, I guess we were. We were very curious, and you don't, until you've been in action, you wonder about yourself, you wonder what it's like, and then you're afraid that something might happen to you, naturally. And so I guess the first few weeks, and well, we arrived in November. We went into the line in January, so for that couple of months, we were ready to listen to anybody's war story and sop up all the information we could get. And then when you finally go into action, it's so damn normal. It makes the average training exercise look exciting. Well, when we went into the line first, it was just a winter static line, so there wasn't a hell of a lot of excitement there.
Where was this when you first went in?
We went into the line opposite a place called Orsonia, which was about, I remember, 7 or 8 miles, or maybe 5 or 6 miles west of Ortona, on the same sort of east-west road that Ortona lay. Ortona was on the coast, and that's where the Sea Force had a tremendous battle around Christmas time. We went in as a support for, as tank support for a brigade of the 4th Indian Division opposite Arsonia. I think we relieved, we relieved New Zealand tank people. Took over their positions. And they went off to Casino, to fight at Casino. And I guess the 4th Division was gradually pulled out and ticking around there too, because they fought at Casino. Well, anyway, we went into the line, and we were in a position with Gurkhas. Very interesting troops. And that was quite a pleasant introduction to the war. There was a little bit of shelling, but not too very much. And it gave us sort of a chance to get our feet on the ground. One of the interesting aspects of that little period was the fact that one of our officers by the name of Molly Milgrath, who died 2 days before Christmas, he was fifth troop leader in the squadron. In those days, we were organized in 5 troops. And when we went to Italy, we picked up tanks from the 7th, we picked up the first battalion, Royal Tank Regiment tanks. There were only enough tanks for 4 troops. So Molly Milgrath didn't have any tanks. And then he heard that there were some New Zealand tanks out in front of our position, which I'd run over mines or had problems and they had to be abandoned by the New Zealanders. So he went out with his men, looked them over, fixed them up somehow, and pulled them out, and got them back, and got them running, got himself a troop of tanks. Until the New Zealanders heard that...
Then they want them back. I was going to ask that until the New Zealanders saw
that. So he had to turn them in. But that was a fairly quiet thing. And then we left there and we went moved over a little further towards Ortona. And my troop was sent forward to be the forward troop with an infantry battalion, another infantry, another Indian battalion with the 8th Indian Division. And we spent about 6 weeks there, and the rest of the squadron was back in a sort of a harbor, uncommitted situation, and I was forward with the battalion. Had a very interesting time. Used to go to dinner with the Indian officers two or three times a week. They were right up in the forward area, but they'd lay out the silver and have the servants and have a drink before dinner and a little bit of polite conversation. All the company commanders used to come in, and I think the colonel, if I remember correctly, used it as an opportunity to have sort of an evening conference. Mm-hmm. And then they'd get all their orders, and then he'd have a drink, a dinner, and then take off back to the company's forward area again. And in the Indian Army, you know, there was only one European officer usually per company. Young fellow would probably just be a platoon commander, or at the best a second command of a company in a British battalion. Probably had the responsibility of a company thrust on him much earlier in the Indian Army, and they're really quite special young fellows. They were terrific to work with and to watch the way they handled the men. They were really outstanding. And the devotion and the affection between the British officers and those Indian troops was something that quite unforgettable. That was a wonderful experience, because the British, with their own men, you know, with British soldiers, are usually shits. They really are the treat them terribly.
Yeah. Because most British soldiers are happy to tell you.
That was very, very exciting.
What are conditions like that? You hear a lot about mud in general.
Pardon?
You hear a lot about sort of the mud and the rain and the general bad conditions that winter. Was it pretty rotten winter all in all?
Well, it was, and the mud was quite something I had never experienced in all my life, and the vehicles were always sort of down to their axles in the mud on the tracks that we had to use. The Indian Army, their men, I think, had come to the mechanic, you know, to the use of the trucks and this sort of thing at a late stage of their life, and had nothing but misery. But I used to marvel at men in my squadron, the Strathcona's, who seemed to enjoy taking over these vehicles. When people got in trouble, they'd get into them and move them around and drive them right out. And it wasn't until after the war, when I came back to Canada and was posted to Saskatchewan and ran into the same kind of mud, that I realized that these chaps were thrilled with it, because it was just like home. And so there was a lot of mud, but our lads seemed to thrive on the challenge. One of the worst pieces of mud that I ran into in that particular time was in the 2nd Battalion, the 2nd position we went to with the 8th Indian Division. After they left, a Canadian battalion came in, and the farm in which we were billeted was full of huge vats of wine. And the Indian soldiers had taken what wine they needed and used it in moderation. But when the Canadians, this particularly company of Cotton and Yorks, I think they were, came in, so they went ape when they saw all this wine, and the company, the discipline fell away so badly that the company commander went in into these buildings with his Tommy gun and shot up all the barrels of these huge casks. Some of them were as steep as this room was high, and twice as long, perhaps. Huge, huge vats. So he, in his rage, just shot them full of holes. And of course, this wine flowed out all over the farmyard, and we were wandering around for the next 2 or 3 weeks, and up to our knees in in mud made of wine, and all the sort of a sour smell of half fermented wine. That was one variation on wine.
On
mud.
Yeah.
That was a great. It was a great training area for me anyway, to be out on my own, supporting an infantry battalion and looking after my men. Perhaps visited by my squadron leader once a week. It was a great opportunity to sort of have face a challenge. But again, it was operationally very quiet. There was nothing for us to do. I think, invented a few targets and would once in a while shoot away at things which the infantry wanted us to shoot at, or which we felt might be harboring a lookout of some sort. But other than that, it was a very, very quiet time. And we were pulled out of there in, I think, March of 1944, and then we made great moves across Italy, down south of Cassino, to prepare for the battle in the Lerry Valley, and that was the Hitler line, yeah. And we went through the Hitler line on the 24th of May. It was our first real battle. And
were you running up against German tanks, German armor by this point?
Pardon?
Were you running up against any German
armor? Oh, yes.
At this point?
Yeah, we certainly were. And I can't remember the name of the. I have it in a notebook somewhere. I guess my orders from that, which we got before that battle, which I wrote down. I can't remember the Panzer division we were against, but it was one of the best. I think it was 26th, but I'm not sure now. Our job on this particular battle was to try and seize a crossing of the Melfa River in order to open a way for advance on Rome, I guess. And our recce troop seized a crossing. It was quite a battle on the other side, and Manny of the Westminster Regiment, which is the motor battalion from New Westminster, Manny won a VC that day. Our young recce officer, Lieutenant Perkins, won a DSO, and we, that day and the following day, I think we probably had about 100 killed in the regiment out of, about 600 or 700 in an armored regiment, so it was quite a high proportion of casualties.
A lot of tanks knocked out?
Yeah. And it more so on that day, I think, than any other day afterwards, because I don't, for some funny reason, I know I never did think this thing through as to what happens when the tank gets hit. Whether I didn't want to think about it, or whether, I don't know why. Maybe a lack of imagination. Sort of a standing order which we've been drilled into us, that we'd fight our tanks to the last man, the last round, something dramatic like this. And I think, therefore, people got hit, and first instinct was to, nothing had happened, stay there. But quite often I'd gather when these tanks were hit, there'd be a little bit of a pause and then something would explode, and then there was no chance, it was just burned. And that first day, there were several crews which were caught in their tanks, were burned, and all we found were little piles of ashes in the various crew positions afterwards. There was nothing. But after that one day, we had some bad habits that day too. We picked up from the 1st Brigade, who were fought slightly differently than we did. And they had told us that the stowage in the tanks wasn't sufficient for the number amount of ammunition you needed. And so we had stacked 75 millimeter ammunition on the floor of the turret and all over the damn tanks and all the sponsons like cardwood.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not in the armored protected bins which are designed for the tank, and again, I guess, you know, you get those hit and they would add to the problem.
Yeah.
So after that, well, I remember on my first day of fighting thinking that we'd been firing all day. That was the impression I had after a few hours, that we fired a hell of a pile of rounds. And then I think I asked my gunner to tell me how much we needed, because I had to make up an order form for the squad leader. And if I remember correctly, he said, well, we need something like 12 or 13 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference between your impression and what really had happened. So it's funny. Anyway, we never did carry all that ammunition again, and I think that was a factor. So a lot of very nice young fellows got clobbered that first day, and then we didn't have those kind of losses after that. We'd smartened up. As soon as the tank was hit, everybody climbed out. If it didn't burn up, then they got back in, but you didn't fool around anymore.
You would have been involved in fairly heavy fighting for the next 2 days, I guess, then.
No, we had that one heavy day on the 24th of May. We were on the receiving end for a lot of long-range fire the next day, which we couldn't really retaliate against. And then the battalion had another battle about the 30th at a place called Tarichi Crossroads, which was quite a bloody little battle. We had a lot more casualties. And then that was the end of the Hitler line fighting for us, and we went back into rest again. War is a funny thing in that you spend a hell of a lot of time waiting around, and the amount of actual time you're fighting is probably in minutes or seconds. And I think once I did a calculation that, you know, I was in the war for 6 years, and probably engaged in exchanging fire with somebody total time maybe 20 minutes or half an hour in 6 years, something of this nature. It's incredible where the time goes.
Seems like a lot longer though when you're involved, I should think though.